Welcome to the second episode of Warmaster Podcast Interviews, featuring the great and the good of the wargaming world. This time features the legendary game designer, Rick Priestley. Rick has made such games as Warhammer, Warmaster, Warhammer 40k, Necromunda, Warmaster Ancients, Lord of the Rings Strategy Battle Game, all while working with Games Workshop, and Black Powder, Hail Caesar, Bolt Action, and Beyond the Gates of Antares, and also Warlords of Eruon with Warlord Games. Thank you for taking part, Rick. I'm sure people are going to be really interested to hear from your thoughts and insights, so let's get straight into the questions. General questions. Question one. Can you describe your journey into wargaming?
I don't think there's anything different about my journey into wargaming than anyone else's of my generation. I grew up playing with toy soldiers, as you do. We all had ethics, and we all had Britain's figures, and you know, we all read the same boys' comics, and I think those things prep you for a liking for those kind of games, and it just morphed from there, really. I mean, the first proper war games I started playing, I'd be about 11 years old, and they were the books by Charles Grant and Donald Featherston, which are available in the local library. So, you know, I would have met other gamers or other youngsters of the similar kind of mind, and we all got together and we all did things from there on. So, you know, it was, that's just the way it was. And I think that's true of so many people my age.
Question two. Tournament or casual gaming, which type of gaming do you prefer both to write and to play?
You know, I don't really make the distinction between tournament or casual gaming. I just write games I'd like to play. And the context is usually social. So if you like casual, but sometimes those games can get quite competitive. I don't enter or take part in formal competition gaming very much. I mean, I have on occasions played in competition, but more in a spirit of participation than any hope of victory, mid-table respectability being something I aspire to. So on the whole, I'd probably say a social gamer. I game to be with my friends and to get together, roll dice and drink beer. And that's probably what I think most gaming is.
Question three. Historical, fantasy or sci-fi gaming, which genre are you attracted to most?
Yeah, again, I don't really make a distinction between those sorts of gaming. I mean, I enjoy fantasy and sci-fi gaming because it gives you the opportunity to be more creative as a designer. It gives you the chance to explore the mechanics in a way that you can't quite with historical games, because you're limited by the reality you're trying to reflect. And it also gives you an opportunity to do world building and use your imagination in a way that's not quite the case with historical gaming. But most of the gaming I actually do is historical gaming, because most of my friends are historical gamers. I think that probably tells you more about the sort of gaming that I like more than anything else, because I like to game with my friends, and so I end up playing World War II. Or medieval, or ancients, or Napoleonics, and I can't say that I'm an expert at Napoleonics in particular. I mean, either historically or from a gaming point of view, but that's really not the point, is it? So I would say whatever's been played, that's what I'm attracted to most.
Question four: which figure, either fictional or historical, best sums you up?
Oh Lord, I don't know. I think that's for other people to say rather than me. I don't particularly think there's any character, fictional or historical. I would say, yes, that's me. Let me think. No, not at all. I don't think I stand out in that way. I don't really have heroes in that sense. I suppose I don't know. It's just the ordinary everyday people who took part in the great conflicts of history are the sort of people I identify with most. But of course, those are not the sort of characters that you you read about or learn about, are they? I'll have to leave it at that.
Question 5. You can take one game with you to a desert island. What game would you choose?
Yeah, the desert island question is not usually quite so literal as that. It's usually an opportunity to talk about moments in your life and things that matter to you. But ask the literal question, well, one game with you to a desert island, what game would you choose? I guess a pack of cards. That would be very useful. There's so much in a pack of cards. And I grew up playing conventional card games. It was much more of a thing, perhaps when I was a teenager and even later. So if I really was on a desert island, well, there'd be nobody to play with, for presumably, unless it's a very highly populated desert island. In that sort of situation, pack of cards, mate, can't go wrong.
Specific questions. Question 1. Warhammer is almost 40 years old now, being first released in 1983. So that means you've been making games for almost 4 decades. Which of the many, many games you've written is your favourite and why?
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, Tatch? Actually, I've been making games for more than that, because Warhammer wasn't even the first thing I did. Richard Halliwell and I published at least 2 games before we joined Games Workshop, starting in the late 70s. So it's more than 40 years, really, I've been publishing. So which of the games is my favourite? I don't know. I mean, they're all your favourite when you write them. And in that sense, your favourite is always the last one you did. But of course, what happens is, as you play them and other people give you feedback and you become more familiar with the rules, they evolve a little bit. And there are always things you think, oh, I could have done that better. I could have done that better. And in the end, you go, you know, that was great, but, and it's the but, you think, it's great, but I could have done that little bit so much better. Or it'd been better if I'd done it this way or that way. Or if I'd only had the opportunity to do this or that. So you kind of then move on to something else. So in many ways, your favourite is always the thing you're working on or the thing you happen to have done most recently. The thing I did most recently was the Erewhon game, which I had some great fun with. The only thing I've got on my plate at the moment is the third book of the Red Book of the Elf King game for Lucid Eye. That's the only thing that I've got in the future. So I guess I'll have to get back into that, and that'll become a new favourite. But just looking back, you know, which one do I regard most affectionate? It's very hard not to. It's very hard not to put 40K up there, simply because it made such a huge difference to both to Games Workshop and to myself. So it's certainly been the most influential. But whether that makes it a favourite or not, I don't know.
Question 2. In an interview earlier this year, Warlord Games CEO John Stallard said that you gave him the game Black Powder for £1 and a curry. Being a curry lover myself, I have to ask, what kind of curry did you get, and was the deal worth it?
Yeah, that is true. At the time, I was still working for Games Workshop, and my contract of employment actually made it... in theory illegal, but in practice unethical to accept money from any other kind of employment. So I kind of had to give John Black Powder, really. The pound's a nominal amount, because he said that he'd been advised that unless he paid for it, it didn't actually guarantee ownership. So the £1 is a nominal amount, and I don't think I ever cashed the cheque. The curry was more of a handshake job, you know. It's one of those sort of things. John and I are both very partial to a curry, and even to this day, we often get together with other members of the East Midlands War Games Mafia and go out for a curry and a natter. So it would be just a normal kind of routine. I couldn't possibly say what kind of curry it was. It would be something nice and hot, I imagine. The the best curry house in Nottingham now is and there are some very good ones, so this doesn't necessarily detract from the others, but the Calcutta Club on Maid Marian Way is quite famous. And if you can get a curry out of John at the Calcutta Club, you're doing well, because it's not cheap and it's not easy to get in there either. But they do a particularly good achari, so I would go for the lamb achari, which is a slightly sour, quite hot but sour curry. That's what I would go for. Thank you very much.
Question 3. If somebody wanted to write and publish a game, what advice would you have for them?
Well, really, it depends on what you want to do, because there's a difference between designing and creating games and playing them and enjoying them, and writing them up in a way that other people can enjoy. It's not just understand, it's also enjoy, because to some extent, a set of rules isn't just a set of rules. At least, I don't think it is. There are rules which do tend to go towards being rules rather than books about wargaming, but I tend to write books about wargaming. And then, if you're going to go and publish, or aspire to publish, you have to figure out how to do that. So you need to work out what your media is. Is it going to be a conventional printed book, or is it going to be something you download, a PDF style thing? Whichever method, you still need to produce something that looks quite good and is professional, so you need to be either capable of doing that yourself or have deep pockets to be able to afford someone else to do it. So you have an issue there immediately. I mean, your many hours, and probably years, spent developing that game are going to come down to nothing if you then have someone produce it poorly. And you can't necessarily control that process as you might wish, unless you do it yourself. But to do it yourself, you'll need to be capable with something like with some sort of production software. Yeah, it could be Cork Express. Adobe InDesign is the one that most people use these days. It's the one I use now. I only do a very amateurish standard of production with it, but nonetheless, I can get away with it for PDFs and free download. But you need to be capable with it. So I'm afraid that means not only having to buy a copy, or these days Adobe is a rental job, so you know you always have to set up a studio. And then you have to be able to lay the thing out. You have to be able to copy edit. You can't copy edit your own material, really. You do need someone else to do it. And the best advice I could give anyone who wants to write War Games rules is give them to somebody who will be honest in their criticism and listen to what they say. Occasionally, you might take some sort of umbrage as a comment, you know, this is not as clear as it might be, or what do you mean by this? You might think they're being picky. But you have to go, why are they saying that? What's the point that they're making? Because they're not just trying to upset you. They might be trying to upset you. But the chances are they're not trying to upset you. They're actually giving you feedback. Now, often you'll get feedback from different sources that's actually contradictory. But again, you have to go, why are they saying that? Because it's the why are they saying that you have to address, not the actual comment. Often that you'll get two pieces of advice about something that are contradictory because you've written something in a way that invites confusion. You might literally be correct in the way you've expressed something grammatically or whatever, but nonetheless it invites confusion because people don't always approach text in a literal way or necessarily a very readerly way. Especially if they're reading it a bit quick, and let's face it, these war games rules, so sometimes people bring their own preconceptions to it. Again, if they're doing that, you have to be able to recognise it. Quite tricky. Having got some sort of way of getting text onto a page, you've got to figure out how to do illustration and diagrams. And these days, those have to be quite good. I mean, I can't really do diagrams. I can do rough diagrams, but I can't do good ones. I know quite a lot of people who do nice diagrams using fairly conventional kind of software. Always tricky diagrams. And if they go into the hands of someone else, you have to be so careful to check them. They always leave them too late. They always don't quite get them right. And then when you correct them, they don't come back quite right. So it's a struggle. And if you can do it yourself, so much the better. But the one piece of advice I would give is if you're going to include diagrams, which I think generally you should, then make sure you leave plenty of time to check them and make sure you get them right. The other thing is illustration. I mean, most books these days sell on pretty pictures, and it has to be said, if you can't illustrate a book nicely, it's going to probably sit on the shelves. It's not going to get picked up. It's certainly not going to have that wow factor that you might want it to have. Maybe you don't care. If you don't care, you're going for a certain sort of market, that's fine. If you're doing a PDF, then it's less important, because at the end of the day, a PDF doesn't have that same tactile quality that a book does. But nonetheless, I'd say that you have to do something. You can use photographs. If you can take decent photographs and you have something to photograph, taking a decent photograph is much easier than having something nice to photograph. I use a digital SLR. It's fairly easy. You don't really need photographic skills to take pictures of toy soldiers. You just need to rat run the techniques, which I won't talk about. I'm sure you know that's one for experts, really. But if you look at War Games mags, you get a pretty good idea of the sort of quality that's expected these days. So you've got all that in front of you, and that's the easy part, because all you've done is produce a great book or PDF. If you're going to have it printed, you're now into expense, serious expense. That's if you haven't already stumped up some thousands of pounds for artwork, which is what it will cost you if you want to pay for professional artists. The book route gives you an immediate problem. How many are you going to print? And if you print fewer than about 3,000 or something, it gets expensive. Printers tend to work on a minimum of that. You can, these days, it's easier to go for lower volumes I'd say 1,000, and even do print on demand. But realistically, if you're looking to have a book which you sell on, print on demand is quite expensive. It's not commercially viable. You might not be interested. You might have deep pockets, and you might be prepared to do this on a kind of hobby basis, and hope to break even no more than that. Again, what are you going to do with these books that you've just ordered? It might be 1,000. Let's say it's 1,000. You've gone, that's a fairly small print run. So that's a minimum print run, really. You've got 1,000 books. They turn up. They'll turn up on a pallet. Where are you going to put them? I had 3,000 copies of Warhammer Ancient Battles sat in my garage for quite a long time. You have to figure these things out. And that actually brings you to the real question of publishing, whether you want to publish or not. And that's, what's your route to market? Because it's easy to publish books and games, relatively speaking. It's much harder to sell them. And unless you've got a clear idea of what you're going to do with these 1,000 books that you've got in your garage, you might be better off not bothering. Go for a PDF or just try something else. Because I know more than one person who's had this great idea to publish a game that's in their head, and they've made the game very successfully, and then not been able to sell the game. And it's sad, because you have all these hopes and you think, well, it's a great game. I don't understand, why aren't people buying it? You go, well, because you're not route to market. How are they going to buy this game? How are they going to find out about it? And really, your printer's bill is going to land on your desk within 3 months, probably within a month of the work being done. So you need to sell some quite quickly to recoup that. That's the thing that most people stumble over. And that probably, if there's one piece of advice about what I'd give to people who wanted to write and publish their own games, is to figure out how you're going to sell them first. Writing the game, have fun. Producing is great fun as well, if you're capable of doing it. But it's not much fun having 3,000 books stuck in your garage going mouldy, I can tell you.
Question 4. Without breaking any NDAs, can you let us know what game or games you are working on at the moment?
Yeah, well, when I finished with Erewhon for Warlord Games, the fantasy warband game I did last year, the year before, I pretty much decided that was it. I wasn't going to do anything else that was as demanding as that, because actually what I found was I don't have the concentration or the energy that I had when I was in my 20s and 30s, or even 40s. And it became laborious. And also, I don't have that same cadre of fellow designers to call upon that I did when I was at Games Workshop. Now, that doesn't matter all that much if you've actually got lots of friends who are interested, but none of my friends are really interested in playing fantasy or even science fiction games. Very few. And so although Erewhon became something I enjoyed playing, I didn't get the chance to play it as much as I'd really like. And putting it together, it felt a little bit as if it was being railroaded through, rather than something that was going to be done lovingly and with real sort of passion. So I'm pleased it got done. And it was very kind of Warlord to take it on, because it was a little bit of a last-minute project for them. But I thought, you know, there's no point in doing that. It's not worth the effort. It's better to just stick to gaming as a hobby in future. I mean, I'm in my 60s now, so I consider myself retired anyway. And as is my wife, who also worked against Workshop. So I think, you know, I don't really need to prove it anymore. I've designed any number of games, so I'll just do things as and when they come along, if the opportunity presents itself. But other than that, I think I'm pretty much done with certainly big projects and working on main sort of games. So I'm not actually working on anything at the moment. I'm doing little bits and bobs for Antares, but mostly for Erewhon. And Erewhon was the fantasy warband game. It's been great fun to do it, but because I've not had a chance to play now, this is the middle of 2020, we've been in lockdown for 5 months. So there's been no gaming, or very little gaming. I've played a few board games, but other than that, there's been very little wargaming going on. So although I have warbands that I've developed for Erewhon and some ideas I'd like to push out, because I've not had the chance to play with anyone, I've not really finished them, or I've not gotten to a stage where I'm confident they could be published. I might just bite the bullet and go with it anyway, but I think, yeah, you have to put a caveat on that and say, you know, I'd say off the top of my head, but these are not properly played like I would normally play them. And there's nothing like playing games or warbands to actually, iterations of games, to actually get the basic stuff ironed out. There'll be something in there. There'll be something which will throw up a contradiction with another rule that I won't have spotted. But it'll come out and play. And you play games into existence. And I think that's true with the individual army lists or warbands anyway. So I've got a few of those on the go, including a Flying Monkey warband, which is using the Eureka models. Eureka is actually... I think it's a New Zealand company, but it's the UK version is run by Nick Simpson, my friend Nick. And Nick actually was the main, probably the main playtester for both Antares in its early incarnation and Erewhon. So, so he has kind of a place in those games. And he sells the Eureka models, which includes these flying monkey. I think they're called Fez. Flying monkeys with fezes, fez flying monkeys. And they're inspired by the Wizards of Oz. But they're nice little models, cute. And I've done an entire warband for them. So I suppose I'm kind of working on that. I've actually just finished with that, really, but I've not put the warband list up. And other than that, the only thing I have on my plate for the future is, as I said earlier, the third version of the Red Book of the Elf King game, which is something I do with Steve and Joe from Lucid Eye. And again, that's a game I really enjoyed working on. And it's a nice game. It's limited in terms of its scope, deliberately so. And it's very focused on the magic, again, deliberately so. But it uses a lot of the same mechanics as Erebon. We always planned on doing three books, but of course, the Lucid Eye chaps, they do get distracted. And I think that's what happened. They've found other things to do, other projects. But they will. They promise me they will get back to the third book soon. So who knows? That's the thing that I have looming on the horizon.
Question 5: What do you imagine the wargaming landscape will look like in 5 years' time?
I can't really imagine what the wargaming landscape will look like in 5 years' time. It does seem that we are seeing more games coming out which are effectively board games rather than what I would call a tabletop war game. Often full of toy soldiers produced, presumably in China, cheaply, and quite nice designs too. And I'm thinking of things like the Command and Colour series. I think the Plastic Soldier Company have just released a science fiction version of Command and Colour is called Red Alert. I say think because I've got a copy, so I know that. And Red Alert is a great example. It's a fantastic little concept where the toy soldiers, the spaceships, are really beautiful. And it's good. And the box is crammed with figures. Great value. If you just want the figures, buy it. But the gameplay doesn't benefit from the figures. They're almost irrelevant. They're used as tokens. A unit will have, say, three spaceships in it, and as it goes into combat, you lose one spaceship on the roll of a dice, usually the equivalent of a 5 or 6. They're actually special dice, they're fancy dice, but that's the equivalent of a 5 or 6, usually, or 6 in some cases. So they don't have any integrity as models. They're not being treated as you might a ship in a World War II naval war game. They don't manoeuvre in any way. They just move from one hex to another together with all the other ships in the same unit. So really, they're just markers. And in fact, if they were counters, you could stack them, and that's probably how the game was designed. It feels like that. But I see games going like that a lot. I think another Plastic Soldier Company game that's come out recently, or is about to come out as I speak, is the reissue of Britannia, which I think Avalon Hill used to do. That's the same. It's got lots and lots of toy soldiers in it, which just act as counters, and are slightly hard to tell apart. Again, it feels like a game where those ought to be counters, but the toy soldiers have been added, presumably to add value. And I just see a lot more war games that have that character to them, or a lot more games that have that character to them. So that distinction between a toy soldier game and a board game is sort of merging. And the traditional war games with units of toy soldiers in the Donald Featherston and Charles Grant tradition seems to be something that the younger gamers in particular don't have any patience with. Perhaps I can see why. I think it's partly because the standards of presentation are so high these days. I blame Facebook and other kind of social media for this. The standards of painting are so high. But if you were a 12 or you're a 12 year old approaching wargaming for the first time today, you'd look at those and go, I can't do that. I mean, I can't do it. Whereas when we were 12, we just, you know, we knew how to paint our FX figures, and we knew how to paint our tanks and our planes, because we'd been doing it since we were 5 or 6 years old in some fashion. And we just slapped the paint on, we didn't worry about it. But you can't do that now. And you go onto Facebook and you see a model that someone's painted and it's beautiful. And they go, oh, I don't know about this. Do you think that's the right colour? I might just put it back in the dip and strip it. And you think, oh my God, we'd paint 30 figures a night. The next day they'd be on the war games table and the varnish would still be tacky. You know, we didn't have any angst about it. And I see the creepy angst amongst the traditional wargaming crowd. You know, it has to be great, it has to be beautiful, it has to be fantastically painted. And I don't see that angst in the board game crowd, which I think is why the toy soldiers have that appeal with those guys. But I don't know whether it'd be more like that or less like that. Who knows? But that seems to be the way things are going at the moment.
Bonus question. If you could go back in time and change one thing about Warmaster, what change would you make? Mine would be to reduce the relative strength of Command 10 generals.
Yours is probably quite a good suggestion. The game does work around the average, and I think Command 10 is certainly pushing it. It gives those armies such a huge advantage, particularly in some circumstances. So it's the predictability is the main thing, and I probably would agree. In fact, if you look at the fantasy, I mean, I presume you're talking about the fantasy version of Warmaster, but if you look at the fantasy version of Warmaster and then the Warmaster Ancient Battles book I did, I think that's the answer to the question, because when I did Ancient Battles, I basically took the Warmaster game and put all the things right that I thought I'd not quite got right in the first one. To some extent, you can accept a degree of extreme results with fantasy that you wouldn't necessarily want with a historical game anyway. I did bring down the command values, for example. I think the other thing that I changed this with the Warmaster fantasy game quite early, we did an update. I changed the way that the facing worked to make it harder for units to attack others in the flanks. I hadn't anticipated there was a loophole in the rules where it was actually easier to charge something in the flank by facing away from it, and I hadn't quite sussed that out when we playtested it. And in the updated version, I just replaced the rule with a slightly more standard Warhammer style front, flank and rear quarter rule, as you'd be familiar. I would say one of the things about Warmaster was, when I did it originally, I was determined not to repeat anything that I'd done in Warhammer. I wanted to create an original set of rules that didn't rely upon any of the well-tried and trusted but over-familiar Warhammer game system. So it led me originally to actually do a chart. When I was creating the game, I did a sort of casualty chart where you developed a factor from your attack, cross-referenced it with the number of stands fighting, and that gave you a result. And it's a little bit like the old WRG Ancients kind of 20 men, 20 casualties, and you take a figure off sort of system. And all my playtesters hated it, and they said, why don't you just do it like Warhammer? And it was the one thing in the end I said, okay, we'll do it like Warhammer. So you roll to hit, you roll to save, yeah, okay. And I have to admit that slightly niggled me at the time, because it meant that I'd broken my own ambition, which was to do something that didn't use any Warhammer rules. And that's why I had that different way of calculating flanks and front charges originally. So there's those two things, they both snuck back in there in true Warhammer fashion. And I have to say the game's better for it. So I can't really regret it. So I think those are changes that were made that were definitely to the benefit of the game. One before it's published, and then one after it was published. Would I change the command values? Yeah, probably. I'd probably do lower command value and a bonus rule to compensate for it, like a reroll or a one-off result on you know, if you miss by one or something like that. Just to give those armies a little bit of character. The character I was aiming at was that they were highly mobile, very excellent command factors, but the character that that came out of it mechanically was that they're very predictable. It wasn't predictability I was aiming at necessarily. I'd go. If I had to change something now from the game that it is now, that would probably be something. But that's an army. To be honest, that's an army list to change. I never regard army lists as inherently part of the game. They're always something that's up for development and change. Yeah, but I'll go with that one. I'll take it.
It's been a real pleasure and a privilege to speak to Rick and to get a glimpse behind the curtain. I'd like to go on record and say thank you for the games that you've made, especially Warmaster, which has provided endless hours of entertainment over my 50 years of life. Well, maybe not all 50 of the 50 years, but a good proportion of the 50 years of my life. Thank you for your time and answering the questions and your insight, and good luck with your future endeavours.